Nobody would have heard of Sex Pistols if it wasn't for Malcolm, but nobody would have heard of Malcolm if it wasn't for the Sex Pistols.
That's Glenn Matlock, original bass player with the Sex Pistols, just over 40 years after they shocked Britain, and more than 20 years on from their reunion. I'm Graham Mack, and my guest this week on London Calling is Glenn Matlock. But first, here's what's been going on in Britain this week, and what's been winding me up about it. Why are we still ignoring the fact that the bloke who carried out the attack on Westminster Bridge last week wasn't a terrorist? He was a nutter. Politicians are looking for all sorts of ways to link him to terror organisations so they can bring in new laws to control us. You see, politicians are power-hungry megalomaniacs. They are hungry for power. The more they control you, the more powerful they become. Now the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, has criticised messaging services like WhatsApp for potentially allowing terrorists to communicate undetected. She's called for encrypted networks to build backdoors into their systems so terrorist messages can be accessed during investigations. Well, Scotland Yard said that the attacker wasn't the subject of any current investigations and there was no prior intelligence about his intent to mount a terrorist attack. Yes, the attacker sent a message using one of these networks before the attack, but we don't know if that message had anything to do with the attack because it was encrypted. And he wasn't under any investigation. So if there was a back door, it wouldn't have been opened till after the attack, so couldn't have prevented it. What is she on about? Here's some facts that don't get repeated. The Westminster attacker was not a member of ISIS or any other terrorist organisation. He wasn't an immigrant. He was British. He was born in Kent and used to be called Adrian. He carried out the attack alone. None of the witnesses say that he shouted anything about Allah or any other god before or during the attack. The police have carried out a total of 15 searches at various addresses in London, Brighton, Surrey, Wales, Birmingham and Manchester. No one has been charged with anything. He was known to police and had a range of previous convictions for assaults, including grievous bodily harm, possession of offensive weapons, and public order offences. But he'd never been convicted of a terrorist offence. His history of violence all happened before he was supposedly radicalised in jail. This bloke was a threat before he was a Muslim. It looks like he was attracted to Muslim extremism. But like I said earlier, he was a nutter. And nutters are attracted to extremism. They might be attracted to religious extremism, but they can also be attracted to political extremism on the far left or the far right, neo-Nazi extremism. Extremism attracts nutters. Only people with an agenda will describe this bloke as a terrorist. Politicians are top of that list. Adrian, or whatever he changed his name to, had serious mental health issues that weren't picked up or dealt with even when he was in jail. If we want to reduce the chances of this happening again, we don't need access to WhatsApp. We need to put more resources into treating people with a history of violence and mental illness. We got new money this week, new £1 coins. They're supposed to be harder to counterfeit because counterfeiting is a real problem in Britain, not just the pound coins, but notes as well. Mark.
Counterfeit notes.
Yes.
I've got a customer, and he used to work in the print industry, and he had a machine in his house, which was a very good high-quality machine. So
yes.
He put it up for sale on one of the like eBay or something like that.
Yeah.
Sold it. These guys come round to have a look. He showed them how to operate it all. Anyway, about 6 months later, he got a knock on the door from the police.
Yeah.
It turns out these guys were actually faking £50 notes with his machine, and because it was registered to him,
yeah,
they came looking for it and him. They were trying to find out whether he had shown them how to reproduce the £50 notes.
Right, yeah, because if he'd used the phrase, you know it'll pay for itself, that might have been a dead giveaway. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hello, Robert. It's Graham Mack calling from England. You emailed me.
Okay.
What's that music in the background? Am I interrupting something? Are you at some kind of concert?
No, I'm in a conference right now.
In a conference? A musical conference?
Not musical conference. It's not a music. It's a team.
Sounds like I can hear music.
It's not a music.
Sounds like music to me. Anyway, you're the director of inspection at the United Nations Inspection Agent at JFK International Airport.
Correct.
Right. And you've emailed me about this consignment of two metal boxes, and you're convinced they contain cash.
Cash, yes.
How much cash?
I don't know, but it's kind of reveal about $7 million each.
$7 million each? Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm very interested in helping you out. In your email, you say you'd like to give the money to me and keep 30% for yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. Why did you choose me?
Well, due to my work, due to my job, I've been serving my job for more than 25 years. But all they could give me is trash. So I don't want to eat trash. And due to the work, and I need a partner in crime. So I'll do this together.
Okay. So we'll make no mistake here. What I'd be doing, now I'm not uncomfortable with this, but I just want to confirm, what I'd be doing would be a crime.
It's not a crime.
It's not a crime.
The person abandoned the shipment and ran away.
They abandoned the shipment of money?
Yes. So if we don't claim it in time, the government will take over it.
All right, so it's important.
It's either the government take over it, or it's either we take over it.
All right, so it's important we get onto this then.
Yes.
So how will this work?
Right now, I need to pay for the non-inspection fee.
Inspection fee, yes.
And I'll pay for storage fee.
Your storage fee.
And is either two ways. Is either we employ a shipping company that will ship it direct to your doorstep, or I bring it myself.
You could bring the money to me, or
of
have
course,
it shipped
after we could claim those boxes.
Yes.
I'm putting down my resignation.
Oh, I see. Well, of course. Who needs to work when you've got that amount of money at your disposal? I think I might do the same thing when I get my share. Yeah.
So, it's up to you.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, what have I got to do?
What do you want to do?
What do I have to do now?
Send me your full name. Send me your address, send me your closest airport, and your phone number to my email box for verification, and after that, I'll send you all the necessary documents.
Okay, now you're at JFK Airport, yeah?
Yes.
Is that where you are right now?
Yes.
I see. Listen, I've got a great idea. Why don't I meet you there? Because my airport is like, Luton Airport is like 10 minutes away. I'm going to, today, I'm going to drive to Luton Airport. I'm going to get on a plane to JFK, and I'm going to meet you there. So it's, I would say, in about 12 hours. From England.
You call him from the United Kingdom.
Yes. To tell you what I'll do, to make this easier, I'll fly to JFK today, and I'll book into an airport hotel, and I'll see you this time tomorrow morning. What time is it there now?
You know what? Before you could proceed that you are coming down to the United States, number one, you need to acquire the non-inspection certificate.
Yeah, we can all do that. We can do all that when we're there.
Have to do that before you could come to the table and present it at the JFK airport.
I don't know. If it takes
Without
a couple of days. Hey, Robert, if it takes a couple of days after I've got there to work stuff
Robert,
out, I'm
it's
fine.
It's Anthony. My name is Anthony.
I have here that your name is Mr. Robert Amaris. That's not your name.
I'm not Robert. I'm Anthony.
You're Anthony. Okay, Anthony, I do apologize. Yes. Anthony, what we'll do is I'll get myself over to New York and then we'll start the process there because then I'll already be there. I can wait. I trust you. I'm a patient man. I'm going to be there morning. So I'll see you tomorrow morning at JFK. Where do I need to meet you?
Coming down there without the document in your hand is a sabotage.
No, it's not sabotage. What does it matter?
Before you could.
What does it matter?
I'll get the documents.
Please hang up.
Robert? Anthony? Hello? Jane's on the phone from North Yorkshire. And Jane, you want to talk about this attack on Westminster Bridge that happened last week?
Obviously, I'm 200 miles away, but the impact, my sons live and work in London, friends work in the city, are horrified like everybody else. But two things stood out in my mind. The first one, yes, our politicians, they might provide framework for our country. But the people at the front line, the people who actually make our country work, are the doctors, the nurses, the hospital orderlies, the policemen, the firemen, the teachers.
Yeah.
Those are the people. Without them, we're not Great Britain, really.
You're absolutely right.
And I think, watching the doctors run across the bridge,
yeah.
The one minister and member of parliament who ran out...
Tobias. Tobias used to be my neighbour. He lived in the flat above me when I lived in Bournemouth.
Did he?
Yeah.
He's MP for Bournemouth, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
And he's a Green Beret.
He's ex-military. Yeah.
Yes, but that training stood out. I mean, and the guy also, I think, very sadly, lost his brother in a terrorist attack. But he, straight out there, straight to the nub of it.
That's the best of Britain right there when you see that going.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
And another thing struck me that isn't quite so wonderful, and that covers the media.
Yeah.
I was watching it, obviously, in my lounge, safe, and the thinly disguised glee on some of the reporters' sort of faces and in their voices. You know, oh, we're covering this event. This thing's happened. Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
And I thought, could at least look really horrified because people have died. We don't know. At that time, we didn't know what the cost was. But you could almost see them thinking, oh, my career might be going up a few notches because I'm here at the face of it. And I found that a bit, well, shall we say, at best, distasteful.
Yeah.
Of course, the media has to cover it. They absolutely have to. But at least, sort of look as though they're horrified.
Yeah. All right. Jane, thank you so much.
All right.
The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, let us all down badly in the aftermath of the terrible attack on Westminster Bridge. At the end of the day when it all happened, about 4:30 in the evening, she came out of Number 10 Downing Street and we were all expecting a memorable speech, one that would bind us all together. But that's not what we got at all. This is how she started.
I have just chaired a meeting of the government's emergency committee COBRA, following the stick and depraved terrorist attack on the streets of our capital this afternoon.
Okay, I think she meant to say sick and depraved, not stick and depraved. But anyway, that's just a mistake. She's under pressure. You can give her that. But what I can't forgive her for is the way she starts. She starts with, I have just come out of a meeting, COBRA meeting. I. It's not I, situations like this. It's you or it's us. It's not I. You don't open with, I have just come out of a meeting. You open with, we are going to get through this. Poor way to start. She carries on.
The full details of exactly what happened are still emerging.
Okay, so she admits there, we don't really know anything. The full details are still emerging. She admits we don't know.
But having been updated by police and security officials, I can confirm that this appalling incident began when a single attacker drove his vehicle into pedestrians walking across Westminster Bridge, killing two people and injuring many more, including three police officers.
Single attacker. She said it was a single attacker that did this.
This attacker, who was armed with a knife, then ran towards Parliament, where he was confronted by the police officers who keep us and our democratic institutions safe. Tragically, one officer was killed. The terrorist was also shot dead.
Wait a second. She's now decided he was a terrorist. How do we know that? How do we know it was a terrorist? He didn't shout any terrorist slogan. He didn't even shout, God is great. Now, if you look at the definition of terrorism, it's this. A person who uses unlawful violence and intimidation, especially against civilians, in the pursuit of political aims. Without proof of the pursuit of political aims, you don't have terrorism. So she's jumped the gun there. I wonder why that could be.
The United Kingdom's threat level has been set at severe for some time.
And there's your reason.
And this will not change.
There's your reason. The government set the terror threat level at severe. The government announced we were under threat. That is why she's claiming this was terrorism. So that she could say, we told you this would happen. Now, we don't know what the motives were. She should just leave it at that. Don't speculate. Don't declare that it's terrorism when you don't know.
Acting Deputy Commissioner Rowley will give a further operational update later this evening. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all who have been affected.
Okay. She is now 1 minute 15 into the speech before she says, our thoughts and prayers go out to all that were affected. That is where she should have started the speech. That's what she should have opened with. As our leader. All right, she wasn't democratically elected, but she's in charge. That's what we wanted to hear first. She desperately needs a new speechwriter. She started with, I have just come out of a meeting. That's disgraceful. The people who've been affected by this, start there. Have a bit of compassion.
To the victims themselves and their family and friends, who waved their loved ones off, but will not now be welcoming them home. For those of us who were in Parliament at the time of this attack, these events provide a particular reminder of the exceptional bravery of our police and security services, who risk their lives to keep us safe.
We're now almost 1 minute 45 in before she mentions the police and what they did. She should have opened with this.
Once again today, these exceptional men and women ran towards the danger, even as they encouraged others to move the other way. On behalf of the whole country, I want to pay tribute to them and to all our emergency services for the work they have been doing, to reassure the public and bring security back to the streets of our capital city. That they have lost one of their own in today's attack only makes their calmness and professionalism under pressure all the more remarkable. The location of this attack was no accident.
How does she know that? The location of this attack was no accident.
The terrorist chose to strike at the heart of our capital city.
How does she know what the terrorist chose? She doesn't even know if he's a terrorist.
Where people of all nationalities, religions and cultures come together to celebrate the values of liberty, democracy and freedom of speech. These streets of Westminster, home to the world's oldest parliament.
Now that's factually incorrect. It's not the world's oldest parliament. Thousands of years ago, the Greeks had a parliament. The Romans stole the Greek system. The Romans had it. Thousands of years ago. Not the world's oldest parliament at all. That's a lie.
Are ingrained with a spirit of freedom that echoes in some of the furthest corners of the globe. And the values our parliament represents, democracy, freedom, human rights, the rule of law, command the admiration and respect of free people everywhere. That is why it is a target for those who reject those values.
How does she know this person rejected those values?
But let me make it clear today, as I have had cause to do before, any attempt to defeat those values through violence and terror is doomed to failure.
Terror again.
Tomorrow morning, Parliament will meet as normal. We will come together as normal. And Londoners and others from around the world who have come here to visit this great city will get up and go about their days as normal. They will board their trains. They will leave their hotels. They will walk these streets. They will live their lives. And we will all move forward together, never giving in to terror.
Once again, we don't know if it was terror.
And never allowing the voices of hate and evil to drive us apart.
And even if it was terror, you're doing the wrong thing by saying they hate and they're evil. The people who do these things in the name of terror, the people like the likes of ISIS, they believe they're right. They believe what they're doing is the work of their God. They don't believe they're evil. Just calling them evil is childish. So that was the wrong thing to say. If it was terror, that was the wrong thing to say. If it wasn't, any relationship to terror was the wrong thing to say. And starting out your speech with, I've just come out of a meeting, was totally the wrong thing to say. This is how bad she got it. The only voice of reason, politically, at the moment, is coming from, you won't believe this, the USA. Rex Tillerson, the US Secretary of State, this is what he said. We condemn these horrific acts of violence. And whether they were carried out by a troubled individual or terrorists, the victims know no difference. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. We condemn these horrific acts of violence. Of course you would. And whether they were carried out by a troubled individual or by terrorists, the victims know no difference. He managed to say in a few seconds there what Theresa May failed to say in over 4 minutes. Airport security checks are a joke. Now, there's a Muslim laptop ban. When you fly to Britain from the Muslim countries of Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Tunisia and Saudi Arabia, you're not allowed to bring a laptop or tablet computer onto the plane with you. You have to put it in the luggage you check in. Now, apart from it being easier now for your laptop to get lost with your luggage or stolen, this just proves that all of those security checks you have to go through are useless. Until the Muslim ban came in, every computer you took on a plane was x-rayed and inspected. You had to put them through the x-ray machine separate to your other stuff. No, is there a laptop in there? Is it take it out? The laptop has to go in a separate bin. Is there a laptop in there? It has to be separate. Now they're saying it'll be safer to bury them in your suitcase. Since we've had heightened security at airports, they haven't found anything that can bring down a plane. Not a single thing. All they've done is confiscate gallons of drinks, mouthwash, and shampoo, and made you get into a negotiation with them over hair gel and jam. And along the way, they've missed things that did cause problems on planes, like the shoes Richard Reed was wearing and the drawers that the underwear bomber was wearing. By the way, Reed was flying to Miami from Paris, and the underwear bomber was flying to Detroit from Amsterdam. France and Holland not on the list of countries where you can't fly with a laptop. And this new rule doesn't apply to mobile phones. It's strange. The most dangerous thing that's caused trouble on planes lately is the exploding Samsung Galaxy Note 7. Let's meet this week's guest. It's the original bass player from the Sex Pistols, Glenn Matlock. He joins me now from the other side of London on the phone. And Glenn, this year it's 40 years since Anarchy in the UK, the song that you co-wrote, first became a hit in this country. Times were different back then. For anyone who wasn't around, just give us a flavour of what Britain was like in 1977, socially and politically.
Yeah, everything was a mess then. There was almost a hung parliament. There was strikes. There was rubbish piled, 20 foot high in the street because everybody was on strikes. There was power cuts. It was the IRA going on, everything. It was a real air of despondency, and it seemed like there was no future, and we wrote a song about it, which was really called No Future, but everybody knows it as God Save the Queen. But around about that time, to try and shake things up a bit, we came out with a song called Anarchy in the UK, which at the time seemed like it might be a good idea. But I mean, it was that bad. I remember we was just starting gigging, and we started playing out of London. We went to Liverpool, and we did a sound check. I think he was playing a club called Eric's. And I just picked up a local paper to pass the time. And the headline on the front page was how, because the grave diggers were on strike in Liverpool, they were seriously considering burying people at sea in the Mersey estuary. It was that bad.
Yeah.
So something had to change. And along we came.
But the band was kind of apolitical, though, weren't they?
Well, I think we just spoke our mind about lots of things. I mean, John particularly. I mean, John was the main lyricist, but I contributed. I mean, a song like Pretty Bacon, that was my lyric. Lyrically, that was like a Primal Scream kind of song. Not the band Primal Scream, but the Primal Scream sort of gut-wrenching. You know, what can you do about things that you don't know what you're going to do about anything, but you're going to do it anyway, and you'll get somewhere by a crook. I mean, that's basically what he's saying.
Yeah. And have things changed that much, really, in Britain since then?
Yes and no. I mean, everybody looks a bit hipper. Well, at least people don't have long hair and flares anymore, although that's coming back. Everything looks outwardly a bit hipper, but it's also a lot straighter. It did change for a bit. It was good. It was exciting. The music was back in the power with the kids' hands, and I think it was realer, and now it's all become a bit more corporate and all that X Factor stuff, which you get in the States anyway, so.
Yeah. So what do you think?
That's an odd one. Cool. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing with the Pistols, everybody seems to think we were some kind of socio-political movement, like the Angry Brigade or something like that. I mean, it was a rock and roll band, with a difference. I mean, Steve Jones has just not long got a book out, which I haven't read yet, called Lonely Boy, but I'll give him a plug for it.
Yeah.
But I know, I saw a little quote from him, and he said, listen, look, we just went in and made a record. What people put on top of it is another matter. Now, it's good that people didn't think we was a you know, the same as Captain and Tennille or in England, Foda Rogers, you know. Yeah. But it's, I don't know, people put things on your shoulders, and some are cool and some are not. You know, we just did what we did. We did what we did out of arrogance, spite, cocksuredness, and just wanted to carve a bit of a way for ourselves. But we did it a good year before any other British band did that. And I suppose that's why we're the Sex Pistols. But we never saw ourselves as punks. We saw ourselves as the Sex Pistols, and the punk thing kind of came afterwards. It was a thing that was put on our shoulders by journalists.
Well, let's go back to the beginning then. Where'd you grow up?
Where did I grow up? I grew up in a place called Kensal Green, which is up the Arrow Road, which is top of Ladbroke Grove Way in sort of central West London. And it was one of the earlier kind of immigrant communities. After kids at school were of West Indian extraction, we used to play British Bulldog. You know, but I'm talking about at junior school, you know, before I was 11, yeah. And the cry would go up, you know, two teams, British Bulldog, you know, when you play just running around, bumping into each other.
Yeah.
And somebody would shout out, Blacks against Whites. So we go, all right, and they always beat us because they're better runners. But, you know, they're all mates and stuff, but it, you know, this is like in the early 60s, and in the summer it was great. Everybody had their windows open. It was all Blue Beat and Scar pumping out the windows, and in fact, my mate Denzel Elaine, his mum and dad split up, and his mum took in lodgers. And one of the guys, he used to come and have a kick around in the street with us. He was older, but he was one of the guys out at the Scatterlights.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So it was, you know, it was kind of cool. And then the sort of 60s moved on, and you'd see people in Afghan coats and flares and bells around their. I was too young for that, but you know, bells around their ankles and stuff, and driving around in army surplus jeeps. I always remember that line. It really touches a chord in me, a Rod Stewart song. She was tall, thin and tarty, and she drove a Maserati faster than sound. I was heaven bound. That's one thing, setting the scene of like what you're trying to achieve as a young kind of bloke. But the next line is, I must have looked a creep in my army surplus jeep. And the bloke up the road had one. It was all that kind of going on, you know.
Yeah.
And it was exciting. I was young, you know, 13, 14, 15, starting to listen to music. My big favourite band out of all that bunch, and I always say this, and I was very fortunate to play with them about 5 years ago, was the Faces, you know, and they opened the door to me to lots of music. But what I dug about them, and Steve and Paul from the Sex Pistols liked about them as well, is that they really sort of had a pre-punk, don't care attitude, and they seemed like they had a laugh about everything all the time, always.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we had in the thing. I mean, lots to do with the Pistols, even after I left the band and Sid was in the band, and they made a pretty vacant video, is Steve wearing a knotted handkerchief on his head. Now, any self-respecting guitar hero would not do that, but Steve did that because we had a real tongue-in-cheekness about us, you know, that comes out of, you know, lots of British culture and even musical, and it's all in there somehow.
Yeah. And were you listening to any of the proto-punk stuff coming out of New York, you know, like the Ramones?
Well, this is the funny thing. People always say to me, "What? Who came first, the Ramones or the Sex Pistols?" And I always say neither. Now, because we got involved with a bloke called Malcolm McLaren, who was our manager, and he had a clothes shop, which was basically our headquarters, and where we all met down King's Road. It was like a teddy boy shop. And he would go backwards and forwards to America, and he got involved with the tail end of the New York Dolls, and he heard about bands like the Heartbreakers starting up when Richard Hell was originally in them. And Blondie and Television and Ramones, and he would bring back pictures and flyers. But none of those bands had made any records.
Yeah.
So we didn't know what they sounded like. And we was doing our thing.
Yeah.
And they might have heard about us a little bit. And then there was a bit of discourse. Quite good mates with Sylvain from the New York Dolls. And actually, there was a bit of talk a long time ago about him even coming over to try and play guitar with us. But although we was hip to each other, nobody had heard each other's music. And when the Ramones first came to London and played at Dingwalls, we all went en masse to see them, and it was shocking how close to us they were sound-wise. And I think that's because everybody got fed up with the same kind of boogie rock or disco or you know, the Philadelphia sound, which was fun. I mean, I remember going down to Sombrero, which was a gay club, with Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood doing the hustle. It was all kind of mixed up in there, but it was just funny how, you know, mainly the Ramones and the Pistols were similar, but just arrived at the same place from different sources.
And when you got to see the Ramones finally, did you regard them as kindred spirits or as massive competition?
Yeah, I think so. I think the guys in their band, the musicians in the Pistols, did. I don't know if John did quite so much, but you'd have to ask him about that. I don't know.
Yeah, you know. And you went to St. Martin's School of Art. What were you hoping to do for a career before the band took off then?
I went to art college purely because I'd read that any English band that I'd read about from the 60s, like the guys from The Who or The Stones or The Kinks or The Yardbirds, had all gone to art college. I went to art college to try and get in a band.
Right.
And it was, the funny thing was, I sort of found a band outside of that and then booked the very first couple of Pistol shows at art colleges because I went.
Yeah.
You know, I could draw a bit. I was interested in art, but my main reason was to get into a band. And there was a scene. It was the only scene that was kind of going on for people who were a bit more, I don't know, just sort of sidestepped everything. The only thing that was really going on in London was pub rock, and that was for older blokes who wanted to play sort of American R&B, which is nothing wrong with that, but there's a big difference between American people doing it and English people doing it up the Kilburn High Road, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And so you become a founding member of the Sex Pistols. You're the original bass player. Now, how did that happen? Because you were working in Malcolm McLaren's shop, weren't you, on the King's Road?
Well, Steve and Paul came in.
Yeah.
And with a couple of other people. And they was always trying to get Malcolm involved, and Malcolm would humour them a little bit. And I remember one day, Malcolm said to them, "How's it going?" And Paul went, "Oh, I don't know, we're trying to take it seriously." And but our bass player, Del, who was his, I think he was his sister's fiancé, he never turns up. And I heard him, and I said, "I play bass." And I said, "Do you?" And I said, "Yeah." And I'd sort of been learning a bit, and I had one. And I went, "Oh, what bands do you like?" And I said, "The Faces." I went, "Oh, great, come round." So I did, and that was it. I was in.
And you,
this was a long time before. This was about a year before John was in the band.
Yeah, and you mentioned it was a Teddy Boy shop. So for Americans, that's selling like 50s memorabilia, but the British style, the drape suits and the brothel creepers and that.
What in American Graffiti, that the guy, what's the guy who wrote, managed to run away, Kim Fowley.
Yeah.
Kim Fowley's in American Graffiti, and he is dressed like a teddy boy would be.
Right.
So if you haven't seen it, go and see that movie. He's got like a long fingertip length draped jacket with a velvet short collar. And yeah, that was a teddy boy thing, which was named after the Edwardian look from the 30s, when working class kids were dressed like toffs, and then they became known as teddy boys.
And in the mid 70s, there was a bit of a revival of the 50s kind of
thing.
There
was a bit of a revival, and I think there was a backlash against all the flouncy, flowery, fanny bands like Barclay James Harvest and Yes and Genesis, you know, which didn't really have anything to do. You know, it was all a bit.
Yeah, and that...
It was all a bit dopey, really. You know, so Malcolm had a fantastic jukebox. Little Richard on it, and Gene Vincent, and the Ventures. Saturday Night at the Duck Pond was one. They did a kind of a rock and roll version of Swan Lake. You know, it was called Saturday Night at the Duck
Pond. And there was some amazing... Because it was like ground zero, the King's Road, and particularly that shop. Because Chrissie Hynde worked there too.
Chrissie worked there for a bit. Not the same time as I did. But there was a bit of a kerfuffle when she got the job that I wanted. You know, the full-time job. I just went right there on Saturdays. And then she left, and then I got the job through there. And that kind of coincided with taking the band a bit more seriously and finding John.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all kind of mixed up in that kind of period.
And what kind of bloke was Malcolm McLaren?
He was a very interesting character. I mean, I would measure people up for draped jackets and things, and I would have to go through his address book to find the number of the tailor to call the measurements through. And he called Malcolm, didn't have an alphabetical
system.
But, you know, I'd be farming through it. And, you know, people would be like the editor of the NME, there'd be Yoko Ono's phone number, and the International Times, which was a big sort of radical paper back then, and I don't know, maybe the Angry Brigade and the IRA, you know, all stuff like that.
And the IRA, did you say?
I don't know if it was the same IRA, but right. I mean, definitely remember thinking, well, you know, I just thought, well, he's an interesting bloke. And, you know, I just worked there at first, but then I needed a referee, just somebody to give me a reference when I was playing at Art College. And because I asked him, he took more interest in me. And Vivian Westman said, well, I don't know if you want to asked Malcolm to give you a reference, and I said, why not? And she said, well, he's been thrown out of every art college in London. So I took a bit more interest in him, you know. Yeah. We talk about things and stuff.
And how important was Malcolm McLaren in the whole story then?
Well, he's very important, but, you know, he tries to... Well, he's gone now, you know. But he tried to make out he did everything. He didn't. You know, he helped us, and we used him as much as he used us. He was certainly a mentor, and I think he tried to kind of use us to sort of vicariously sort of further his career in the entertainment field, shall we put it.
Yeah.
You know, he was his kind of clay. But all along, you know, Malcolm thought he was fooling us and we was making a horrible racket. He never knew that we was any good. And the only reason people like you call me up today to talk about it is because the content, there was a lot of substance there with it. And Malcolm never saw that. He really thought that he'd just created some kind of media exercise thing, you know, a bit like a louder version of the Bay City Rollers. There was some teeny bop band that was around at the time. So, I would say nobody would have heard of Sex Pistols if it wasn't for Malcolm, but nobody would have heard of Malcolm if it wasn't for the Sex Pistols. We had a symbiotic relationship.
And where did you rehearse?
Various places. Originally, there was a guy in a band called Wally Nightingale, and Steve Jones was the singer. This is really early on, even before it was called the Sex Pistols. But Wally's dad was an electrician, and he got the contract with Hammersmith Council to kind of go through this place that was called Hammersmith Studios right by Hammersmith Bridge. And it was this massive, big complex. And we just got a set of keys cut. It was supposed to rehearse there, but it purportedly had this big screen up, and it was supposed to have been the best sound dubbing room in Europe, you know, where people would sing to the picture to do lip sync and stuff like that. It was our rehearsal room. But something happened, I won't go into it. Wally left the band and we had to split. And then we was in little rehearsal rooms. I do remember once we was in, we tried rehearsing out some rehearsal complex underneath the Roundhouse in Camden Town. And they was actually doing a Radio 3 or World Service broadcast of some classical music piece. We was making so much noise. They're going, turn down, but you're going out to Somalia on our classical thing. We're going, we pay good money for it. Like that. And then we ended up with a place in Denmark Street, which was like England's Tin Pan Alley. And we found our own place there for a while, which was great, because you could leave all the gear set up and get on with it and turn up every day and not have to set up all the gear up and have a little play and find out quite quickly if anybody's got a good idea for something or not. And it was then, that's when we kind of wrote most of what became Never Mind the Bollocks album.
Yeah. And you were living there at the time, weren't you, as well,
Steve?
Steve
lived there for a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a dump, but it was a central dump.
Yeah. And Johnny Rotten's audition was actually in Malcolm's shop, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
How did that happen then?
Well, we was on the look. I mean, we would stop anybody in the street who had short hair and looked a bit different, because everybody but everybody, including the milkman and the bank manager, would have long hair, slightly long hair and flares, so it was relatively easy to see somebody who looks a bit different. We just had a word out amongst our chums to look for somebody, and I think it was Bernard Rhodes who spotted him, said, look out for this guy called John, and then he came in the store. I wasn't there at the time. Malcolm saw him, and he invited him round, and we came round for a drink in the pub next door, and then we went back and opened up the shop, and he auditioned in front of the jukebox and sort of mimed along to I think 18 by Alice Cooper, which was a weird scenario.
Yeah.
For him, you know, but he fronted it out really quite well. And yeah, so he had something. But it's funny, when Bernard Rhodes said, oh, you got a singer, and he said, yeah, and then we met him, he said, I said, so look out for this bloke called John. And he said, yeah, this bloke's called John. He said, no, the other one. And the other John, who happened to be mates with Johnny Rotten, was John Beverly, who became Sid Vicious. And it was all kind of mixed up there.
More from Glenn Matlock in 2 weeks' time. In part two of my chat with him, hear about the Sex Pistols' first big break, which was front page news over a swearing incident on TV, and how things changed when they became famous. The relationship that Glenn Matlock had with Johnny Rotten changed, and Glenn ended up leaving the band before the first album came out. But then he reunited with them in 1996. There's lots more to tell in this big story from Glenn Matlock in 2 weeks' time on London Calling. Next week, my guest is another bass player, Chris White, the bass player with the Zombies. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk. Subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. Put your Skype details in there. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. You spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.